A government-sponsored health plan can sound simple. Give consumers one more choice and let it compete with private insurance. But NABIP believes that competition wouldn't be equal and that lower provider payments, cost shifting, and pressure on employer-sponsored coverage could ultimately leave consumers with fewer choices and less access to care. As a public option program moves from proposals to operating plans in several states, what have we learned? What's NABIP doing now? And what do benefits professionals need to watch in their own state? Let's get briefed.
This is the Benefits Brief, the official podcast of the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals. Your fast track to what you need to know to stay sharp, informed, and ready to deliver for your clients. And now, here's your host, former NABIP president and award-winning podcaster, David Saltzman.
And to help us understand all of this happiness, we've invited Megan Fearing. Megan is currently the chair of NABIP's State Public Option Working Group and NABIP's Region 7 vice president. She's a third-generation insurance broker and an owner of Insurance Marketing Enterprises, a Colorado-based agency serving businesses and individuals since 1979. She's also a past president of NABIP Colorado, has worked directly with policymakers and regulators on legislation affecting affordability, consumer choice, and insurance markets. Megan, welcome to the Benefits Brief.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
Before we discuss all of these ideas, let's spend a moment or two and define them. What is the difference between a public option, a Medicare or Medicaid buy-in, single payer, and Medicare for all? Because I know people use the terms interchangeably. Is that misleading?
It is, yes. And really, you can think of our current system as a hybrid between a private and public system, because we do have programs that coordinate and interplay with the private system. So you have things like Medicaid, or you have TRICARE, which we use for our military. So we, and Medicare, of course, but Medicare is usually for folks that are disabled or seniors. So we do have a hybrid system already. But when we start talking about public option, that's where we're talking about a government-designed plan that has very specific parameters or benefits. And then private insurance companies are either forced or regulated to provide that specific plan design in conjunction with their other plans. Then when we talk about Medicare for all, that's where we're talking about some sort of single payer or truly government-run plan, where they're not only doing the benefit design, they're also one of the payers. They are regulating providers and who can coordinate and play with that program.
So before we talk about NABIP's position, let's talk about all the great folks who work with you and help you work on all of this policy stuff and all of our positions. Who's on the committee with you this year?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a gentleman, Eric Golko. He's from Region 1, so that's going to be our like New England area. We've got Heidi Sterner, who's from Region 8, which is our Nevada, California, West Coast. Then we have Josh Garrett from Region 3. And keep me honest here, I believe that is some of our Midwestern states. And then we have Julie Schubert, and she's also from Region 1. Connecticut specifically. Then we have Leah Denzel, who's from Colorado with me, Region 7. She also sits on the Ledge Council as the Region 7 liaison. Then we have Liz Ortolani. She's from New York. And then we have Pat Burns from California. We've got Robert Molcher, who's from Oregon. And then Robert Williams, also from Region 3, and then Tom Wright from Region 4. He's in the Minnesota area.
It sounds like a really great group of folks. I know a number of those folks, and they're very, very smart people. We got loads of smart people at NABIP, and it's great that we're working all together. So let's go back to this starting point. NABIP's position paper, which has been around for a little while, strongly opposes a public option or a buy-in to an existing public program. What's the central reason for that opposition?
I think it goes back to the catchphrase that we've used, right? Medicare for all means no rights or no choice for anyone, because that means that we are truly on a government-run program with hardly any influence on benefit design or any input on that. And some of the essential health benefits might be right for some groups of people, but not the right fit for others. And when you start removing choice and start removing opportunities for people to seek out what's a good fit for them and their family or their employees, that's where we start to run into some really big issues with a system like that.
I know one of NABIB's principal concerns has been whether the public and private plans would really compete on the same rules. NABIB describes the public option as an uneven playing field. What advantages would a government-sponsored plan have that maybe a private carrier wouldn't?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll bring that back to Colorado. We operate with a public option. And so we have plans that are designed by our state regulators. There are some pretty good stakeholdering meetings that occur as they're considering changing benefits or adjusting deductibles or anything like that from year to year. But ultimately, the advantages or the disadvantage depends on how you look at it, that if a carrier wants to operate in the state of Colorado, they, in the individual market specifically, they must offer one of the Colorado options at every metallic level. So they're handcuffed in that way that they have to carve out at least a section of their product portfolio with those specific plans. Then beyond that, they also are required to meet premium thresholds or premium reduction thresholds, and those are guided by the Division of Insurance. They're also benchmarked off of a prior year's performance. So it's arbitrarily holding the market hostage because the rates are not allowed to fluctuate with what's going on in the economy, what's going on with their risk pool or adverse risk pool, and the influence there is staggering.
Could a public option begin as one additional choice, but eventually reduce the number of private choices?
I am so glad you asked that question because that was our NABIB Colorado's biggest concern and biggest opposition when this was being rolled out legislatively in our state. And the year after the legislation passed, once the plans were part of the market, we saw three carriers exit the market. Two of them exited abruptly. One of them did a slow exit. They lasted about a year. But after that first year, they had exited the market as well. So we went from having about eight carriers to about five.
And that's definitely not the direction we want to be going in. What could lower public plan reimbursement rates mean for doctors, hospital, and patients? And would that cause a cost shift?
According to our commissioner of insurance, no, that never happens. He is actually on the record testifying to that effect. But I will tell you candidly, that's just unrealistic, right? We have seen it happen. We have rural hospitals that are contemplating shutting down because so many of their patients and people in their community are either on Medicaid or a public option plan because those rates are controlled, those public option rates. So similar to Medicaid, their reimbursements have just plummeted. And they are contemplating what it looks like to have multiple counties without a rural hospital. And geographically, there are many states, right? We've seen it in Washington. There are concerns about this in Nevada that also has some public option regulation. During our working group conversations, we compare things with Connecticut and Massachusetts, right? They're right next door to each other, but vastly different in size. The further west you get, we're talking about massive amounts of geography you have to cover where there could be huge care gaps if hospitals and provider groups aren't earning enough to keep their doors open. And we're seeing that happen.
I think the corollary to that is what it might mean for network adequacy and the time it takes patients to get an appointment. We've seen lots of examples in other countries where it could take 6-8 months just to get an appointment. Do you think are you seeing any evidence of that happening?
We are. Now, this is more in the Medicare space, and I don't want to confuse the topic here, but I think it ties into the Medicare for All suggestion. In four counties in southern Colorado, we've had two carriers announce a service area reduction because one hospital system that controls three of the local hospitals has pulled out of their network and CMS shut them down. They said, you cannot operate in these counties because of network adequacy concerns. You have people that are driving more than 100 miles to seek care. So you can no longer operate in these counties. We would see similar issues if we were to roll something like this out across the country, especially in our states that geography is a big factor.
And all of those effects don't necessarily stop at the individual market, right? Could they reach the employer-sponsored plans as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because there are a lot of states that have rolled out public option legislation that involve their small group market. And so those rate reductions, those reimbursement changes, that all will impact that group or that segment of the market as well.
And then there's the effect on an employer plan's risk pool if some employees migrate out to a public plan.
Sure.
Again, are you seeing any evidence of that yet in the states that have these options? Has that
we
impacted?
Are. Absolutely. We're also seeing the impact with the ICHRA model, right? Those individual coverage plans, yes, they're still technically under the group, but then we're farming all of that risk out to the individual market, and we're seeing a disparity between the risk pools.
Assuming something like this happened, does it change or diminish the role of benefits professionals?
I actually think it will enhance it, because if you look at the way that Medicare has operated, for heaven's sakes alive, it's the most confusing thing out there to the general public. And so they are desperately looking for someone to explain to them how their government benefits interplay or coordinate with private benefits, how they enhance their coverage. We call them Medigap plans because we're acknowledging there are gaps in the government program. So I firmly believe that these public option plans, or whichever direction our country ends up going, there will be a need for advisors in multiple capacities to not only explain how things work, but how to work within the guardrails of those plans and make sure that you are filling in the necessary gaps for whatever your care needs are.
You alluded to this earlier, but we have some real-world state experience beyond where you are in Colorado.
Yep.
What have Washington's Cascade Select plans, Colorado's Colorado option, what have those taught us so far? Have they delivered on the promised savings and enrollment and consumer choice?
If you believe the PR statements that are coming out from the respective division of insurances, yes. But I don't know that's factual, right? When we talk with Robert up in the Pacific Northwest, he operates in Washington and Oregon, from my understanding, and he's just seeing a ton of issues with that. Lack of competition, lack of plan choice, because a lot of the carriers, whether it's complacency or just they're frustrated, they are defaulting to these option plan designs. And so people are losing the opportunity for true choice in their benefit design. Nevada, I think, will be doing some interesting things in the upcoming year. We also have a few states, Ohio, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Connecticut, Vermont, they're all talking public option, New York, Massachusetts. So we're getting to see what this will look like across multiple states. But in the two states that really have functioning, in that they have people enrolled, it's moving forward, they are providing insurance. But in Washington and Colorado, we're not seeing the true results in the market that we were sold, that we were told were going to happen as a result of this. I do think it's arbitrary that some of these numbers, it depends on what statistics you're looking at in order to drive the news topic that it's saving money.
Yeah, I hate to give politicians and departments of insurance more credit than they're due, but just an opinion question. Do you think that some of these dilatory actions that have happened in the markets where these plans are, do you think they were intentional? That they knew that they were going to drive out some of the rural hospitals and create a crisis they could then step in to fix? That they knew that they were going to drive some carriers out of the market? That they knew they were going to screw up the risk pool?
You know, David, It's interesting that you ask that. I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist. I'm just not. But I have been saying that since the Affordable Care Act was passed, that I believe some of this has been very intentional and very poignant in how they're different factions are going after the market to tear them down to then be the ones that come in and rescue it. And I do think that is what is happening in these states.
It's like a little kid who kills his parents and then pleads for mercy from the court because he's an orphan.
Yep.
So let's talk about the actual working group, the State Public Option Working Group itself. What's the group doing proactively, like before a bill is introduced or gains momentum?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been working for a couple of years now on developing some keywords and things that our members can be keeping an ear out for. If you start hearing that a piece of legislation is going to contain these topics or these keywords, these are some things to pay attention to, because a great way to get something passed is to tuck it into another bill that maybe has nothing to do with the actual public option or that kind of thing. We see it all the time at the federal level. So we've worked on those keywords. We are also currently working on a really nice infographic to be able to distribute that kind of explains the current system, what a public option looks like, what Medicare for All looks like. And that way it's a great leave behind if you are talking with any of your public folks at the Division of Insurance, regulators, that kind of thing. But just that way it's easy to explain to your peers as well, right? If you are out there at an industry event and you hear somebody talking about it, it's a great piece to have and explain what's going on. So we're working on those two things. Then as far as legislatively, if we do hear about a piece of legislation that's been introduced, diving in, seeing what's actually in the bill, are there pieces of the draft that are palatable, right? Are there things that could help improve the market? In Colorado, what we did was tear apart what we could. So there were some things where it was like, all right, we understand that from a voting standpoint, this is going to get through this year. They finally have gotten it to that. So where there are areas that this is palatable, we were able to remove some of the restrictions on providers and their forced participation in certain networks. We were able to remove some of the benchmarking on premiums so that it was more of a market-driven statistic. And then we were able to peel out some of those pieces of the legislation. So ultimately, that's what we're doing with other states. So as Connecticut gets ready to potentially introduce theirs, we've also heard New Mexico may introduce some legislation. So certainly keeping an ear out for those keywords. Then if something is introduced, proactively looking at the legislation, the draft bill, and then also working to spread the word with that infographic and making sure that people are well aware of the distinctions between the different programs and what that could mean for Americans.
Beyond the infographic, which I think is a great starting point, is the working group also developing model legislation or alternative policy solutions, talking points, data testimony, rapid response, resources, all the stuff that we usually use for big initiatives?
Yes, that's a great question. So some of the tools that we're working on are the rapid response tools if a piece of legislation is introduced. As far as draft legislation, there's been a lot of conversation with our government affairs team about what does it look like? Do we draft something like that? And I don't know that we do, right? We don't necessarily have the formula for a perfect model, number one. And number two, this isn't something that we want to see touted out across multiple states. So if there's a way for us to be on the defensive, I would love to be on the offensive on this, but the offensive means shutting it down. So introducing draft legislation is the opposite of what we're trying to do.
You mentioned our government affairs team. Are there other ways that the group works with NABIB state chapters, Ledge Council, coalition partners, et cetera?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Across a couple of states that have tried to run legislation with a public option or single payer system, we have worked proactively to help them find coalition partners locally in their state, whether that's their chambers of commerce, other business groups, consumer advocacy organizations. So we work very actively at the local level, kind of a grassroots effort to help them build those coalition partners. And then also work to identify where they can be working with legislators, right? Educating them on the regulatory impacts and the legal impacts of rolling out things like this. So there have been a couple of different avenues that we've taken to do that at the state and local level.
Is there some place or are there places where the working group could use additional expertise and participation?
Oh man, that's a great question. We are always looking for different perspectives, especially for folks that have lived abroad and have input on how they've seen systems work in different countries. I think that would be very helpful. And then one of the other things that we would like to see is if someone has experience working in a system like that, right? So if they have that experience and have seen what that looks like, for example, in Australia, they have a government plan. Everyone has a base plan, and then you can buy supplements either through your employer or occasionally as an individual. So if someone had experience like that and how that actually functions, what that looks like on a basic level, I would love to hear about those experiences so we can work to integrate some of that thought process as we're combating some of these.
So what should a benefits professional do if a public option or a Medicaid buy-in or single-payer Medicaid for all proposal pops up in their state?
Let us know right away, right? We're monitoring it. We have all the tools out there that crawl the web to look for that kind of language. But if you hear about it just in a one-off conversation, you're at a campaign event and somebody mentions something off the cuff, let us know. The sooner we hear about it, the better. And then we can start talking about strategy, what that looks like. We need to use PAC dollars to help out with coalition participation, that kind of thing. And also putting together materials that are state specific. We can work towards that. But I think letting NABIP know the sooner the better, especially if you have insight into who the bill drafter might be or what caucus they tend to lean with. That's all really good information to help us with working towards a good outcome for consumers.
So if members want to get more involved, who should they contact?
They can certainly contact me and we can share my contact information. They can also get in touch with our government affairs team or anyone that is participating, if one of the folks in our public option working group, or you have your state legislative chair, your state president, any of the folks within your NABIP leadership should be able to get you connected with us.
So Megan, as we wrap up here, if listeners remember only one thing from this conversation, what should it be?
Great question. I think that advocacy is key. Keep your voice out there. Make sure that you continue to advocate for choice and continue to advocate for the consumers that you serve.
Megan, a great answer. Thanks for joining us. And please extend our thanks to everybody on the State Public Option Working Group for the work they're doing on behalf of NABIP members and also for the people we serve. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I will definitely pass along that information.
I'm David Saltzman, and until next time, you've been briefed.
Stay ahead with the Benefits Brief. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or catch every episode in your member-exclusive Washington Update each Friday. To learn more about how NABIP helps you succeed, or to become a member, visit NABIP.org. That's NABIP.org.